Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Bradley Manning's 35-year prison sentence is amplifying the debate over the Obama administration's prosecution of whistleblowers, government employees who leak classified information to the public. Manning was serving as an intelligence analyst at a base in Iraq when he gave hundreds of thousands of classified documents to the anti-secrecy group WikiLeaks. And a military judge gave him the longest sentence ever imposed in such a case. Was the punishment justified? Does the punishment demonstrate that Edward Snowden was smart to flee the country before he leaked official secrets? Our guests today will address these questions, and they'll discuss how these high-profile cases affect other whistleblowers, along with other insiders considering whether to stick their necks out and expose perceived government wrongdoing. Rahul Sagar is an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Secrets and Leaks, The Dilemma of State Secrecy. Tom Devine is legal director of the Government Accountability Project. His group has been advocating on behalf of corporate and government whistleblowers since 1977. Peter Van Buren was a State Department Foreign Service officer who led teams assigned to reconstruction projects in Iraq. His book about that experience is called We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Now in Washington, Peter writes about Iraq and the Middle East and national security at his blog, We Meant Well. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Hi.
Thank you.
So because it's in the top of the news, I wanted to find your reaction to the Manning sentence for exposing American military and diplomatic activities around the world. First, we'll start with Tom.
Well, the Manning sentence represents a much larger phenomenon than just his case. And the sad facts of life are that you really don't have much alternative to leaking to outlets like WikiLeaks unless you want to be a martyr. We had landmark breakthroughs last year in job rights. But silence enforced through repression is at an all-time high, as we're seeing with the way people like Mr. Manning or Mr. Snowden are being kind of hung out to dry and made an example of. That's what's happened is that as job rights have improved, the reprisal techniques have shifted from job harassment as the most feared threat to retaliation through criminal investigations and prosecutions. And next month, our group, GAP, is launching a major criminal campaign, major congressional campaign, for a lot of decriminalized whistleblowing. And we're nearing the climax of a similar campaign in Congress that's got a good chance to succeed, to add a lot more teeth to the Military Whistleblower Protection Act so that folks like Mr. Manning would have had a safe alternative to leaks. But we're completely hitting the wall on job rights for in-house disclosures in the intelligence community. All the whistleblower laws have loopholes for intelligence workers who try to work within the system. And that's at the insistence of the same House Intelligence Committee chair who's condemning whistleblowers for not working in-house. And what we're really seeing is the power structure creating a catch-22.
Right. We'll get more into details about what's ahead. Peter, what's your opinion of the Manning sentence and its impact on whistleblowers?
Well, the Manning sentence was obviously intended to put his head on a stake in the Pentagon lobby as a way of scaring off people. The easiest book to censor is the one that's never written. The easiest whistleblower to silence is the one who is afraid to not speak up to begin with. Manning's sentence is clearly out of line with his actions. People who literally spied against the United States on behalf of foreign governments get lesser sentences. William Calley, who murdered 22 people in Vietnam, served far less time than Manning is going to be. It's clearly designed as a symbol, and unfortunately what it is a symbol of government overreaction.
And Rahul, I wanted to get your opinion on this. Now, Edward Snowden exposed the NSA's secret surveillance program known as PRISM. Are Manning and Snowden heroic whistleblowers or criminals who've endangered national security?
I very much respect both the work that Tom's doing as well as Peter's wonderful book and his advocacy on behalf of whistleblowers. My position is, I'm more interested in the general case rather than very much in particular specific people, because we don't always know, sitting on the outside, we don't always know all the details in both these cases. Mm-hmm. But let me say this much. I think there are two points that I'd like to flag. The first is that they'd be tried, they will be tried under very different laws, I suspect. I suspect Snowden won't be tried under Section 793, which is usually what we talk about when we talk about the Espionage Act. He'll actually be tried under something very different, which is Section 798, which is for communications intelligence. And the law there is unequivocal. It prohibits all revelation of communications intelligence. And on the question of what we should make of them, my concern with both of them, and this is where I was trying to maybe distinguish myself a little bit from Tom and Peter, is that I think we can all agree that secrecy and government activity, covert activity, is troubling. And when individuals bring that information to light, my main concern is emphasizing the ways in which they should do that. So yes, internal whistleblowing can actually be very dangerous and difficult for whistleblowers. I agree completely. We have good examples of that on this show. But I think at the same time, how the whistle is blown is very important. And in both Manning's case, where he revealed far too much information, I completely support, for instance, the reveal of the revelation of the information on the Apache attacks, but revealing unredacted the names of informants around the world. I know from having spoken to bureaucrats and done interviews and investigations that it did have a very negative impact on informants, on their personal lives, on their professional and political lives. So I think he was not sufficiently measured. And the same danger is starting to appear with Snowden. In the beginning, his initial disclosures were understandable about the Fourth Amendment and internal surveillance. But revealing that we're spying, that the U.S. is spying on Chinese communications or on European embassies is going too far. So the distinction between what is good and bad whistleblowing, I think, or desirable and undesirable whistleblowing, regardless of the character and the personality of the person, is whether it's measured, calibrated, careful, not sensationalistic. That's what I'd emphasize.
And Peter, would you say that the good outweighed the bad in the Manning case in particular, and then the Snowden?
Absolutely. It becomes very difficult to sit from afar and try to parse all this out. Manning did release an extraordinary number of documents, let's just say 100,000. And to go back and say, well, if 73,000 seem to be disclosures that benefited the public, that's okay. But if it was only 49,000, well, then he's not a whistleblower. I think that's drawing the lines far too fine, particularly under the circumstances that many whistleblowers have to acquire the information that they do share with the public. I think what might be a better way to look at this is to say that it's up to us over time, over the span of years, to truly evaluate the disclosures that Manning, Snowden, and the future whistleblowers actually give out. And it's oftentimes difficult to do that in the heat of battle, if you will, and certainly under the pressures that the media attempt to apply to us as thinkers, that these acts are putting blood on people's hands or the like.
Now, Manning did say during the sentencing hearing that he was sorry that he hurt the United States. So while there's no question that he broke the law, Tom, what about the sentence? Is that going to be a long-term problem for people who are considering sticking their necks out and becoming a whistleblower to expose their perceived wrongdoing?
Well, I think of the sentence as the latest attack in a war to terrorize whistleblowers. The key thing about the Manning case is not passing judgment on Mr. Manning, and the professor's right. We don't know the full extent of documents that were released or the positive or negative impacts. The key lesson to be learned is that the intelligence community and their backers in Congress are driving people like Mr. Manning to leak to organizations that may or may not have hidden agendas. And people like Mr. Manning don't have the professional expertise to responsibly screen all these documents. But there's no safe channel within the government to go to perform that function. It's an act of professional suicide if they do. We had whistleblowers at the National Security Administration on domestic surveillance who did everything the right way. They went to the NSA Office of Inspector General. They went to the Department of Defense Office of Inspector General. They went to the House Intelligence Committee, the same as the chair, Mike Rogers, said that Mr. Snowden should have done. What happened? They were all put under criminal investigation. They all faced raids of from 10 to 20 FBI agents at their house at daybreak simultaneously. One of the whistleblowers, Bill Binney, he said good morning to a pistol pointed at his head in the shower. This is what happens when people do it the right way. We've got to make it safe to take responsible action when you want to challenge abuse of power.
May I speak to that as well?
Okay, yes.
Please. In my own case, working at the State Department, the disclosures that I made were not classified per se. They were there was information that was certainly actively kept from the public's eye. It was hidden, if you will. And I, again, attempted to go through a number of channels prior to the decision to go public and write a book. While in Iraq, I spoke to my supervisor, who told me to be quiet and go away. I tried to speak with the ambassador, but was never given an appointment. I spoke with the deputy chief of mission, the sort of vice ambassador, who told me essentially, shut up, get through your year, and go home and forget about all this. I did try to speak with the special inspector general for Iraq reconstruction, and was told that they were really interested in prosecutable crimes. If I knew of anyone who was putting money into their own pockets, come back and talk with them. Coming back to Washington, I attempted to speak to the people in the State Department who control Iraq policy and received no response. I contacted the U.S. Institute for Peace, which is, in fact, a government organization, and was told really they were only interested in an oral history project, and I might be able to contribute something in the future to that. It was only after all of those channels were shut off that I decided to disclose my information publicly in the form of a book, and faced, as Tom Devine explained, a year of legal, judicial, and personal harassment leading up to a bitterly fought-out settlement that forced me into an early retirement. So the channels option, as from personal experience, I look at extremely carefully.
Rahul, not to get too personal, but do you think that Peter was justified in doing this, or did he just not have enough patience to stick with the system?
No. In Peter's case, I'm extremely sympathetic, and this is another point. I apologize if I sound too much like an academic or an ethicist, but there are, what we try and do when we think about the ethics of these things is to pass important distinctions. And so one important distinction is between the revelation of classified versus unclassified information. And what I understand from Peter's book and his comments right now as well, much of what he had to say was and discuss and make public and draw the public's attention to was not classified information. And I for that reason, I believe the kind of retaliation he faced was needless and overblown. So it's one thing when someone reveals classified information, another when they don't. And even when they reveal classified information, I think you can make a second distinction, which is objective wrongdoing. So, clear, gross corruption, clear wrongdoing, torture, secret prisons, things that are vastly clearly illegal. The other instance in which you might reveal classified information is when things are more gray, it's not entirely clear what the bounds of the law are. This is not torture, but surveillance, for instance. And that is where you need to be a little careful. And that's where you need to be discriminating and calibrated. So I think it's important that when we look at whistleblowers and leakers, that we not club everyone together. I completely agree with Tom and with Peter that there have been absolutely reprehensible instances of unnecessary, gratuitous targeting of individuals, and that's incorrect. But at the same time, we shouldn't then paint everyone with the same positive brush, because there are people that are revealing information that ought not to be made public. There doesn't seem to be a good justification for doing it. Showing that we're wasting money in Iraq, yes, that is worth knowing. Knowing how and which particular drone was used to kill which particular al-Qaeda member who happens to be a bomb maker, and there was no collateral damage. In that instance, I don't think we should be revealing the information. So it's about precision and care.
Rahul, do you think that it is justified in revealing that the NSA has been collecting emails of hundreds of thousands of Americans and phone records?
It's a good question. Now, let me preface this by saying I can only speak on the basis of what we roughly know, and I place a great deal of faith in the institutions, including the FISA court, in the idea that they are keeping far better tabs on this than you and I can.
And they just found, and they recently found.
Having said that, as a response to your particular question, yes. And this is something I urge readers to do as well, there's an excellent blog that looks at the very specific national security law aspects of this. I'm not associated with the blog, I just am a fan of it. Lawfare, which is run by a whole set of excellent national security lawyers. And one of the things that becomes very clear looking at the legal analysis of this is that the Supreme Court has not prohibited, and in fact has allowed, the collection of what we call metadata, so information about the patterns of communication, not their content. So when we say the NSA is collecting people's phone records, we tend to give them the wrong impression. We tend to make them think people that their content is being viewed. It's being archived, and it could be viewed, but only under a court order. So as long as those processes exist, I don't find that to be a case of severe wrongdoing. And that's exactly why I'm ambivalent in Snowden's case, because I feel what he uncovered was a policy that he disagreed with that is troubling, yes, but it isn't illegal.
And
I think that was the distinction I'd make.
Well, I'm a little bit confused about this because, Tom, didn't the FISA court find that the NSA actions were unconstitutional?
Well, yes, the professor is describing the legal theory that the courts are permitting wide gathering of information but restricting access to it. But that's not the reality. The FISA court yesterday, it came out that over 50,000 times a year, NSA is looking at that information from about Americans who had nothing to do with terrorism. These legal theories they're not very comforting when they have to be enforced in secret in a bureaucracy that tries to prosecute anyone who commits the truth. I mean, for goodness sakes, the professor makes the well-taken point. There's a big distinction between classified and unclassified whistleblowing disclosures. But the government doesn't respect that. The NSA people didn't disclose any classified information to the media. They still faced FBI raids on their homes. In espionage prosecution, trying to put the lead whistleblower in jail for over 30 years. The theory was that he intended to disclose classified information. And that's because...
If I might just jump in there, just to say that I agree with Tom. But I don't think we have a disagreement here. In those cases, the cases that you were just describing, I agree with you that was incorrect. So I don't think our distinction on that point is I don't think we disagree there.
I don't think we have a disagreement either. I think the disagreement is between the law and the reality of government abuses of power.
I think also there's an issue here about using the term legal and law. Because whistleblowing is at its very heart, and I speak from my own experience, an act of conscience. The disclosures I made ended up being unclassified, but that was not the calculus that drove me to say what I had to say. Whistleblowing is an act of conscience, and an act of conscience, almost by definition, requires one to look beyond what is legal and to look at what is right. We can certainly cite throughout history extreme examples of that process, Nazis in their actions in Germany, apartheid. Martin Luther King fought against what were laws at the time. And so whistleblowers step beyond what is legal and look to what is right, and they act on conscience. The fact that the government may draw arbitrary lines and say this is classified and that is not is really not where the discussion needs to be focused. It needs to focus more on the information that is released, as Raul said, but not whether it has a classified label on it or not.
And I wanted to just stop us for a minute here. I want to get into the use of the Espionage Act. But before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. Today on the website now we have an article outlining the 7 times that the Obama administration has invoked the Espionage Act. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter @globaljourn. Now, Manning became the first leaker to be convicted under the 1917 Espionage Act since Obama became president. But, Tom, he's not likely to be the last, is he?
No, this seems to be a pattern of branding whistleblowers as spies, and that's just unconscionable. It's almost as if the government is saying, unless you're a yes man within the intelligence community, or even more agencies, you're engaging in misconduct. And freedom of dissent, that's the soul of a free country. And if we're going to end up having a bureaucracy of national security yes men, that's a clear and present danger to the freedom of all Americans. And that's the stakes behind these individual prosecutions.
Yeah, and just to make this distinction, now the when it became law in 1917, the Espionage Act was designed to target spies and traitors working with foreign governments. So for our audience, when it comes to people prosecuted under the Espionage Act, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were convicted and executed for sharing military secrets with the Soviet Union, and Daniel Ellsberg was a military analyst when he shared the Pentagon Papers with the New York Times to expose military misdeeds in Vietnam. And he was the first leaker charged under the Espionage Act, but his case was later dropped. Rahul, is the use of the Espionage Act justified in these seven cases, do you think?
That's too many and too different cases to club together, so yeah. I can't give you one uniform answer of seven cases. I just add two quick observations. The first is when the Espionage Act was drafted, if we look at the debates at the time when the legislation was passed, it's often said that the Espionage Act was only meant to target foreign nationals or foreign spies and classic espionage. But the debates actually show that members of Congress were also equally concerned about the unauthorized disclosure of classified information. At that time, it wasn't classified, but it was restricted in various ways. And the consensus that they, or sort of implicit consensus that they reached, was that they were going to rely on the good faith of the service and the press in particular to withhold information. And this made a lot of sense during World War One because they were voluntary censorship regimes at that point, also during World War Two. So the use of the Espionage Act now, after 1917, particularly after 1950, to try and restrict the flow of classified information to the press is as a result of a breakdown of trust and agreement between the press and the government. So that explains why, I want to sort of challenge slightly the idea that the Espionage Act has been sort of dragged out of somewhere, out of a closet, and used with no background reference. It was, in fact, this has been a long-standing concern, unauthorized disclosures. I'm not saying it's the right use of the Espionage Act. I'm just saying that's from the beginning been one of the things that the Espionage Act was thought it might be used against, is the unauthorized disclosure of classified information.
Tom, let me share again from my own experience another way that the Espionage Act can be used, an almost insidious way. Early in my case, before I had proper legal representation, the State Department was kind of freelancing what they were going to do to me. And in a meeting with the State Department security people, they waived those seven espionage prosecutions in my face and said, you know, what if we bring an Espionage Act prosecution against you? And even the lawyer I had at that time kind of laughed at them and said, there's obviously no espionage, even by an extreme definition in Van Buren's case. And the security people said, yeah, we know that, but we'll bankrupt you through the process of you defending yourself. And that becomes a real problem when the government has such a blunt tool as the Espionage Act and can use it as a threat even when it's not necessarily even close to legally viable. It creates an atmosphere that is deeply chilling and deeply at opposition to what we understand as the basic tenets of a free society and a democracy.
Okay, and Tom, could you briefly outline the initiatives and that you're doing and some others are doing to try to rebalance this factions of security versus the public right to know?
Well, sure. We're fighting for freedom on all fronts. We're launching a major campaign to decriminalize whistleblowing so that the same rights that you have against job harassment would kick in if you're put under criminal investigation or prosecuted. Ironically, you can be prosecuted for activities that would be illegal to fire you for under current law. We're trying to make over the Military Whistleblower Protection Act and close the loopholes that allow open season on any intelligence community whistleblowers, including prosecutions under the Espionage Act for those who don't make classified disclosures, who disclose unclassified information to the American people. Your point about the Espionage Act really highlights a very scary irony. The Espionage Act is about disclosures to enemies of our country, and we're using it for unclassified disclosures to the public about government abuses of power. I mean, has it come to the point, really, where the American people, generally, our population, is the enemy of the state?
Peter, I really appreciate you coming forward with some of your personal opinions and what has happened to you in the past. Just very briefly, what's your final word on this issue?
My final word is that the government ultimately has and will continue to fail. Whistleblowers, as I mentioned earlier, act on conscience. And the fact that despite the horrendous treatment Bradley Manning experienced, Edward Snowden still stood up. And I suspect that the government, the more it cracks down, the more it will, in fact, encourage fewer but braver people to continue to speak out. And I look forward to people who are as brave as Manning and as brave as Snowden to continue to speak up and inform the American people about the actions of their own government.
Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen. It's been a very good discussion. I appreciate you coming on the show. Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were Rahul Sagar, a professor and author of a book called The Dilemma of State Secrecy, Tom Devine of the Government Accountability Project, and Peter Van Buren. Peter is also the author of the forthcoming book, Ghosts of Tom Joad, Story of the 99%. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Sasu Siegelbaum was the lead producer. Free Press Watch is up next, and please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a weekly segment on Global Journalist where we bring you a rundown of the major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Today's news comes from Egypt and the United Kingdom. Four journalists have been killed in Egypt since the start of a military crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood. According to the Al Aram newspaper, the journalists include Mick Dean, a cameraman for Sky News, Habiba Ahmed Abdelaziz of the Dubai-based Express newspaper, Egyptian journalist Ahmed Abdelkawad of the state-run newspaper Al Akbar, and photojournalist Mossab El-Shami of the RNN News Network. Al Jazeera is also reporting that journalists have been detained by police without cause and have had equipment seized or destroyed. The partner of Guardian journalist Glenn Greenwald was detained for nearly 9 hours by British authorities at London's Heathrow Airport under a controversial section of the country's Terrorism Act. Greenwald, whose stories exposed widespread NSA electronic surveillance programs, called the detention, quote, a profound attack on press freedoms and the news-gathering process. His partner, David Miranda, reportedly had electronics equipment confiscated from him, including his cell phone, laptop, and memory sticks, according to The Guardian. The Terrorism Act has come under increased scrutiny since Miranda's detention, with some arguing that it offers authorities too much latitude to detain and question people. For more information on these and other stories affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week. I'm Raymond Tungekar.